Good morning, friends. And welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of just many lodges throughout the world whose common goal is to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy that began to be written down in 1875. So as we have these gems to study, we can do that either independently, and it's encouraged for people to study independently, or we can all do that together. And by these studies, and it says in the Declaration that work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy. And the goal of that is a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. And we are, we do not have a constitution, bylaws, nor officers. We don't pass a basket around, but we do have voluntary contributions in time, work, and money. We do have a wonderful building that we've had for a while, but it does need upkeep, so we do ask for donations if possible. And in order to spread broadcast these teachings, the lodge here during the summer, and we are in the last month of our summer session, so next month in October we'll start our winter session. But to finish up on the summer sessions, we do have, as today, our Sunday classes run from 11 to 12. The doors open at 10:30, and today's class is True Morality, and we're studying different chapters of Mr. Crosby's Universal Theosophy. Next week, on the 19th, we'll be looking at his chapter on Three Kinds of Faith. And the book that we're using, Universal Theosophy, is lectures of his that people actually transcribed. So we're lucky to have those. And on Wednesdays from 7:45 until 9, we will continue our discussions in the Bhagavad Gita. And the doors open at 5:30. The library is open from 5:30 until 7:30, and there's always a student available to assist in any studies that you might have questions upon. And you can read the part for that evening's class. And the book table in the middle of this floor is open before and after all meetings. So today we'll be looking at an interesting topic. It's true morality. And one thing we would like to point out is that in the cases where we have these small pamphlets, there is a really good pamphlet on moral and social issues, and the origin of evil, the fall of ideals. So if anybody's interested in those topics, we do have this pamphlet available, and it's by HPB. So it's interesting, when one first looks at the title, True Morality, it makes one wonder, what is there a false morality then, if we're looking at the true one? So we will be able to look at morality in some very interesting light today. And we would like to open from HPB's Origin of Evil. And it's just a short paragraph. As mankind multiplies, and with its suffering, which is the natural resort of an increasing number of units that generate it, sorrow and pain are intensified. We live in an atmosphere of gloom and despair, but this is because our eyes are downcast and riveted to the earth with all its physical and grossly material manifestations. If, instead of that, man proceeding on his life journey looked not heavenward, which is but a figure of speech, but within himself, and centered his point of observation on the inner man, he would soon escape from the coils of the great serpent of illusion. From the cradle to the grave, his life would then be supportable and worth living, even in its worst phases. So this kind of gives us a clue where we're going to look today to find where that true morality lies. And we will have some paragraphs summarized. And those are paragraph 1, 2, 4, and 12. And if you're looking in his little book, The Universal Theosophy, it starts on page 119. And does anybody have the big book?
Add 211.
Okay, add 211 to 119, and you'll get you'll get that in Friendly Philosopher.
As was mentioned, looking within for true morality would be the case, and the question was posed, if there's a true morality, is there an idea of a false morality? And the philosophy would say, yes, that's the first paragraph, meaning that what society agrees upon as moral, the ideas that we fix as moral, change with times. What was moral at one time is fixed as immoral in another period of our development. So if it's a changing idea, not a fixed idea, we know it must be false. So it says there is no basis whatever in a changing attitude towards actions. So what we often consider morality, we need to look more closely at. And it says in the second paragraph that the result of those kinds of ideas of morality breed intolerance. And often the people who are most serious about those ideas are the least tolerant towards others' ideas. So it's a bad spin on a wrong idea to begin with. It gets worse and worse. And we'll read in the second paragraph the idea that true morality rests in an understanding and in a realization of man's own spiritual nature and must of necessity flow from it. So as was mentioned, we turn inward for the true idea of morality, and we're told that to find it, we need to first know ourselves, to become aware of our own inner nature. I think we're getting feedback. If it's okay with you guys.
Okay. I'm hearing you.
So we turn then to the fourth paragraph, and it talks about the idea that, especially in the West, the revealed religions have perhaps done more harm than good. The idea of stress being laid on the physical existence and that responsibility for our actions lies on an outside deity are the ideas that really give us difficulty. Human thinking then centered entirely on the physical existence. It's pointing to the fact that the more we look outward for these ideas, the more we're going in the wrong direction. If we rely on the whim or caprice of some being, some God, outside from ourselves, then we become irresponsible for what we put forward. And the whole point of the chapter is that we are responsible for what we do. So turning then to the 12th paragraph, which is on page 123, a universal existence is our salvation. And we want to read this next line twice for impact. When these universal ideas are seen and to some extent realized, one loses all fears. We just thought that was a very important statement. When universal ideas are seen and to some extent realized, one loses all fears. So it says, neither change of death nor things present or to come can have any effect upon that which is constant, that which we turn to within. And it gives the description of one who would have that understanding or realization, saying that he moves among his fellow men, enjoying with their joy and sorrowing with their sorrow, but moved not by it, as we hear in the Gita so often. So it's describing what we would aspire to in looking for these proper ideas. And judging not others because we see them struggling just as we struggle, and we're approaching then a truer sense of morality. At the end of that paragraph, the best thing we can do for anyone is to assist him to understand himself so that he may reach that point of perception and knowledge and power which is in reality his own and which he has but to realize. He being, of course, all of us. Your thoughts and questions are welcome. You want to take questions?
No, take questions. Okay. Well, you can if you want.
A couple, yes.
It says a false morality, and we just really wonder, shouldn't it say a false sense of reality? Because how can there really be a false true morality?
We lost the question. False reality or a false morality?
Morality. I said reality.
Well, a false idea of morality. Well, we think Theosophy would say if we're acting upon the idea, we are creating. So, in a sense, that false morality becomes a thing when we act upon it. So, if the idea is false and we use that in our actions and using the powers that we have, we create something which must have its, as we put out its cause, must have its effect. So perhaps it means a false morality in that sense, that as we employ it, we actually give it power in some sense. Yes?
But there's also a very definite possibility of having a false morality. You can believe it is perfectly right to destroy all of these people, their property, their works, because they are inferior. That's a false morality.
Right, so the knowledge needed to sift through that is what we're lacking. And if we, other parts in here talk about motive being very important. If we check our motive in that action that was just mentioned, we think we would have a different effect if we stop to think about it. Yes?
So when we act from a false morality, thinking that it is true, we will still get the same results from the universe.
Absolutely. It's brought up elsewhere in the part this morning that law rules in all planes of being, in all areas of the universe, however we express that. So that, yes, if we acted with a sense of false morality, the return would be, under law, whatever was appropriate and proportionate to that action. So we would still, of necessity, have to readjust in the future what that mistake was and that karmic effect was.
Okay. Now, we'll take questions not just on the part that was summarized, but the entire chapter. Yes?
What is morality?
What is morality? Morality is a basis of thought that either a person or a group of people use in order to put a framework as a basis for action. Yes?
Perhaps Buddha might say it is the right thing to do at all times.
Yes, the contribution that of Buddha, if we do the right thing for the right reason, that would be an idea of morality. But we could also add to that, but it's somebody's perception of what is right at the time. as we discussed in one of the previous questions, and as what the chapter, the piece starts off with, that in any given time, what can be moral now may not be moral in a future time. But that's not true morality. And the whole talk, I mean, not the talk, but his whole, yes, it was his talk, that's right, his whole idea was, how do we determine what is true morality and how do we achieve that? And he says at the end of chapter one, true morality rests in an understanding and in a realization of man's own spiritual nature and must of necessity flow from it, irrespective of all kinds of conventions. We need to know our inner natures in order to know what is, in truth, morality. So we would think that if somebody is not looking at what man's true nature is, doesn't look at the higher aspect of man, then he's starting from an erroneous premise as to what his framework would be in regards to what true morality is. Yes?
How would we know if we are seeing or centered in that higher aspect of ourselves?
How do we know if we're acting from the higher? Well, that's only something that a person can answer for themselves. But we would think if the idea is true across all types of people, if it doesn't matter what caste they are, where they live, what their race is, we would think that would be a good start for someone to know if they are looking at it from a higher aspect, is if it is good for everyone. Yes?
Wouldn't that be rooted in the basics of all religions, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you? That would be the basis, the start-off point for everything moral coming from you.
Yes, that... And we know that the idea of do unto others as you would have them do unto you is in every single religion. There's some difference in phrasing or whatnot, but that is in all religions. And he goes into, it's interesting, he does talk a lot about, a good portion of this, he's talking about the idea of the devil and the idea that there is a revengeful God. So that's looking towards, when we're thinking of the other religions, we're looking outward to that revengeful God, to the devil made me do it, that kind of a thing. We're not looking inward, which is where he's talking about we need to know our inner nature in order to know what true morality is. So we have to pull it back from looking outward, that somebody else made me do it, the devil, God, whoever, and pull it back inward. Is this a follow-up then?
Yes. Wouldn't that also be addressed by the first fundamental principle of theosophy, which is deity, and that we are all one. There is no differences in us. We consist of the one constant source. The differences mm-hmm. that we see are just imaginary or Maya. So doing unto others as you would do unto yourself, you are doing it unto yourself because we are one.
Yes, when we're looking at this idea of true morality, we are looking at the first fundamental principle because that is the whole idea behind universal brotherhood, is that knowledge of that deific principle in us all that binds us together. So if we hurt one, we hurt all. Yes, in the back.
Is the chief basis behind moral misconceptions in general, would it be the belief in a personal God? Because if one believes that they believe in a
Well, we would think that that's probably, if not all of it, but a good portion of it, because the idea of the revengeful God, that people are praying and waiting for an answer to how they are supposed to act, and that could be a whole false premise. Somebody could think that they're receiving a message from God when it's just their innermost mind telling them what it is they want to hear. So we think that it is a good portion of it, and he does talk about it. He says the true ideas of the ancient philosophy relieve us of two misconceptions, and one is that idea of a revengeful God and the idea of the devil. So we think that that's a good portion, is looking outward at an external God.
Yes. While we can say that about an idea, though, we can't say that about an individual, that an individual who believes in a personal God is going to have a false morality. We have only to look at St. Francis. St. Francis believed in a personal God, but his approach was more on the line of the Sermon of the Mount. And what's the man that went to Hawaii and lived with the lepers?
Saint Damien.
Damien?
Yeah.
He believed in a personal God, but he believed in honoring all others by serving that God. So we can't say that an individual who believes in a personal God is necessarily going to behave in a false way. It's the idea that harms people.
We can expound on that idea of the personal God, because we know that there are examples, as was just given with St. Francis and Damien with the lepers, that someone can believe in a personal God, but that their outlook is universal, their love is universal, that they are still acting from a higher prompt because they are looking at the world in a universal sense rather than just what they can get for themselves. So indeed, somebody can believe in a, and we all know people who are, you know, very much involved with their religion, but then they're good people. They believe in helping others and not looking for anything in return. So it does depend on a person's, where that person is working from. What kind of a framework are they working from? Is it just a personal one, or is it a universal one? And it was interesting too, what was that part? In paragraph 10 and 11, Mr. Crosby's looking at, he goes from a universal idea when he's talking about theosophy and true morality, how it does not depend on words, phrases, or conventions, but upon our universal perception of things. And then he goes on, he goes from a universal idea to the particulars about what a person can do. He meets conditions as they come, does what he can, far from an unhappy being, quite capable of taking all the joy and pleasure that exists in the world. And even though he can see what those are, what those unhappy ideas and actions and lives are, he can still, understand everything that they are going through and join with their joy. Yet himself is free from either joy or sorrow. So what he's saying is that when you bring it down to the particulars, that one can actually see the sadness that is in the world, and one can be empathetic towards those people who are suffering, yet not get caught up in the sorrow and the angst that these people have. So let's talk about motive for a little bit, because He says here, thus true morality may be seen not to lie in the act itself, but in the motive. It depends on the knowledge and intelligence of the being acting. So it's not just motive itself, but it's motive with knowledge, because somebody's motive could be the highest motive there, but if he's not acting with knowledge, one can actually hurt somebody else. So do we have any ideas on that? Yes.
Well, it's a strange example, but people go weekly and throw their money away to buy tickets for the lottery, and if they're by chance interviewed on television, it's, oh, it would be so wonderful if I won this money. And yet, if they were to go and actually look at the results for real people, mm-hmm. what those riches did was destroy them. It's the same thing. If you don't have knowledge about money or how to handle it or what's the right thing to do, then that money is going to pull you down instead of lift you up. So we think we can see that example everywhere in mm-hmm. our own lives. Somebody gives you a wonderful, beautiful, expensive computer, and you don't know anything about them, you're just going to use it to play solitaire. So it doesn't matter what we have. It matters what we know about mm-hmm. what we can do.
Yes, it doesn't matter what we have. We have to know what we can do. Yes, in the back.
I wonder if that, what was stated from the platform, is the root of the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, because people can say, oh, but I want to do this for this person. And, when I get my next check, I'll do that for this person. So it is, you can have these good motives, but if the action isn't taken, and that action with knowledge, it can cause trouble. Yes, in the back.
Well, we need to be moderate in all things and pick that middle path, because both the miser and the spendthrift can cause an imbalance and cause a lot of harm. There's been cases where a miser is hoarding millions of dollars and perhaps someone close needs an operation that would really improve their lives, and yet they're so fearful that they're going, they just keep holding on. And of course, the spendthrift can ruin themselves mm-hmm. and others, the security of the family. So we need to be moderate in all things.
Yes, the idea of being moderate in all things, that the example being given was of a spendthrift and a miser, that they can both cause problems. So being in the middle, just like Buddha said, the middle way, the middle path is the way to go. You had your hand up?
Yeah, I was thinking about what was on the floor, like being rich or being poor puts stress on the self. It puts stress on the spirit, because the rich guy's worried about keeping it, protecting it. The poor person's worried about he wants more. And when you get caught in that, I guess the best place to be is be okay with where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Let your spirit just rest. Lead some kind of a peaceful lifestyle, without getting caught up in all the illusions of the world.
Right. Yeah, the idea that a rich person is worried about keeping his money or losing it, and a poor person needs more. But then there's all those examples of people who are happy where they are, that not looking so much at the material aspect, but the love that they have for their family, and if somebody's rich, donating, helping people with the money that they have, again with knowledge, giving the money away with knowledge. And the poor person, there are many people that are out there that are poor that love, family is important. They help where they can. So it's a person's attitude towards what they have that would make one feel poor. Yes, in the back.
We're thinking the idea of more than one life, the one life idea versus the reincarnation that returning makes, we would think a difference on how one's motive starts out. It might be a much broader motive or universal by knowing that the whole idea of karma and reincarnation is not just this one time for one to worry about.
The contribution having to do with how the idea of a one life can affect somebody's morality, especially with the idea of karma going along with it, if they don't believe that the responsibility is going to come back to them, then knowing that this is their only one life, they may just want to say, you know, go for the gusto, get it all in this one lifetime because this is the only one they have. You had your hand up.
Going back, Ben Franklin, who defined happiness, defined it in different ways, but germane to the subject at hand. Ben Franklin said, happiness is being content with your piece of the pie. And related, something on radio, BBC, a week or so ago, a younger sounding man who's looking at philanthropic ventures, but at some point he's also made a lot of money and just gone entrepreneuring. He mentioned that Warren Buffett, and also been in the news lately with Bill Gates, they have together approved like $60 billion, and they don't quite know what to do with it because they don't want to give it to corrupt governments in Africa, they won't go to the people who need it, etc. That's smart on their part. This fellow mentioned that Warren Buffett is going to take like several billions of dollars and just give it to some charity that has experience how to use money to get a good purpose out of it. And Warren Buffett is going to say, here, I don't know what to do with this money. You do. And I trust you. And that's, you know, a man, one of the wealthiest men in the world, that would that be that altruistic. That's a good sign, at least, whether how it happens, the money will actually be helping people. But it's a good sign. It's hopeful.
Yes. The contribution having to do with the idea that some of the extremely wealthy people are pooling their money together, and which is wonderful, and it's one of those things, and he does talk about in here, we don't want to take the time looking for it, but you know, doing a good thing, the result could be the same, but depending upon what your motive is, again, will determine the karma that you will engender in the future. So we're looking at, hopefully this money will be used for a good cause and these people will get the help they need, no matter what the motive is by these wealthy people. But in regards to the wealthy people, their motive will affect their karma in a previous, in a forthcoming life then. Yes.
Most of our life, we have lived among people who, by popular standards, would be considered poor. But they had food, clothing, and shelter. And when suffering came, they accepted it, thinking that it came from the Lord. So they didn't fight against it. They accepted it. They lived it. They learned from it. And continued a certain peaceful mind with no envy or jealousy of folks who had more, because they thought the Lord felt that people should have more, and so that was their lot. So they were peaceful people and did good things, very selfless, always thinking of the other person, always sharing what they had with each other. And that was their way of life, and they found peace in it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, there are people who, as we were talking about earlier, do believe in the justice that is meted out by an external God, that they deserve or don't deserve it, and their acceptance of it would seem to indicate that maybe they are looking in a more universal sense and acceptance of what their lot is then, and not blaming it on somebody else. or an outside God.
It would seem that those circumstances and those folks were much closer to the truth than perhaps some others. If we just change the word Lord to law, everything that came to them came under law. The first two lines of the very last paragraph, if I might, it is for us then to say which way we shall go. We are not creatures of circumstance. We are not the creatures of environment. We are their creators. So that peacefulness of mind, we think, comes from understanding everything is proceeding under law, and that everything that I am due is coming to me, and I have the power to make it something better. And that, we think, inherently has that contentment and peacefulness of mind, whether or not we cognize these statements, that would seem to be an expression of it.
Yes, that inherently many people have this idea. It was suggested changing the word law, Lord, to law, that everything does come under law, and that there are those people who inherently and may not realize that their contentment may be coming from looking at life in a different way, despite the fact that they feel as though their lot in life is from God and not from their own actions previously done. Yes.
And to go one step further, we should remind ourselves nothing and no one can prevent our getting exactly what we've earned. Not the political environment, not a difficult family, no one, nothing. So we will get what we have earned, and we're in the process of earning other or differently, let's hope.
Yes, the idea that no matter what condition we're in, that we will always get what it is that we have earned. And we can't help but thinking about, I mean, we know that there have been many catastrophes recently, and those people that happen to not be there when normally they would have been there, and maybe they got a flat tire, or they, you know, they forgot something when they went out of the house, came back in, and so they weren't where they normally were when this catastrophe would have happened. So it is. That's how it works, is that if it's not your time to be where something might happen, then, you know, it's not your time to go yet. Yes?
So if we are unable to cognize and truly understand these ideas yet, that we are these spiritual dynamos and in charge of everything that comes to us, can we just begin to work towards true morality by doing what? Are there some steps the philosophy offers us? Act in this way, think in this way. Are there some simple parameters? I think you alluded to them earlier. Mm-hmm. If you're not hurting anyone or anything in your action. So it would seem that although we don't have the true understanding it mentions perhaps yet, we still can work towards that true morality even where we are.
So what can we do then to help ourselves gain a better understanding of what true morality is and how do we get there? We talk about meditation. We talk about reading the meditation books that we have. So we think just by also understanding that we all are part of that deific essence, that we are that, and knowing that everybody, all living things, have that spark of divinity in them, and knowing that we're all connected, the idea of universal brotherhood, and focusing on those ideas. He talked a little bit about evolution in the part as well. And the idea of evolution is trying to perfect ourselves and having our lower nature and under control and trying to be and work more from a higher attitude and trying to continue doing that. Well, we know it's hard every day when we have to look at the mundane aspects, but even that, looking at the mundane aspects of our work, it, finding the sacred in whatever that may be too. And it's a matter of progress, that the more we can function in this attitude, that the more the probability of us of looking at true morality and being able to put it into practice will come easier to us at that point. Yes?
We were thinking of the idea of always thinking about the oneness of life in our relationship with other people. But we also have to realize that there are some things that come to us that are quick and shocking. And if we have not taught ourselves to practice the virtues, which will remind us of the oneness of life, we can very easily go the other way. So we think, in order to express high morality, is to always have those virtues close at hand. Mm-hmm. So when these things happen to us, instead of reacting to them, mm-hmm. we can go through those virtues and find the right thing to do.
Yes. One of the ways we can look at true morality is when something happens to us that we totally are not expecting, that we can act instead of react to what it is that had happened to us. In other words, like keeping your head in the midst of some, you know, horrific action that has just happened, and practicing the virtues at that point. And if we have been doing it, it just becomes second nature to us. Yes.
Almost we said, like, at a certain point, I'm realizing that this is God's creation. Some like the mind of God. I'm just happy to be walking around in it, to be encased in the body, just to walk around, just appreciate creation as it is. You know, I'm just happy to be here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just happy to be connected, to realize there's a higher intelligence, and I'm just here learning some kind of lesson on earth, whatever it is, but I'm just happy to be around.
Okay.
To be spiritually connected,
yes,
to that creation. Realize that. It's like everything kind of glistens. It's kind of wonderful. I just, you know, just to be here.
Yes, the whole idea of what, if we actually look at what has transpired when we think of our lives and being out in nature and seeing what is out there and trying to treasure it, is and treasure life in general, is a wonderful thing. To be aware that life is there to be treasured, and just that awareness that what is it, the t-shirts that say life is good, you know, I think they're so cute, but just to be aware of how precious all life is. Yes.
And we think it, the very end of the part points to spreading just those ideas, just sharing them with others, because it will help raise their spirits. That phrase is a reality. It will help raise the spirit of the entire universe if we are speaking those ideas from our heart and sharing them with another, particularly when they need them, when they reach out to us. That effect can be tremendous.
And to go on with that, he says on page 123 at the bottom, true morality does not depend upon words, phrases, or conventions, but upon a universal perception of all things, whereby everything is done for good, every thought and feeling expended for the benefit of others rather than for oneself. That's a big, big thing, because he's saying where everything is done for good, every thought and feeling expended for the benefit of others. I mean, he's not saying just some of them or most of them. He's saying all of it. And that's a big order. And just if we can be cognizant of the fact that this is how we should be acting, for the good of others. And if we can try and make contact with that thought periodically throughout the day, if we can interrupt those mundane things and realize that they're spiritual too, then we would, in answer to the question a little bit ago about how do we go about it, then that is at least a start. Yes?
It's interesting. We can see the evolution of morality on a social level by the documents that by certain historical documents, including our own constitution, and it shows us as that evolution takes place, the documents become more universal. If you look back at, like, say, the Magna Carta, which really didn't do much for the common man, it limited the rights of the kings. But then when you get to the Constitution, and it tried to embrace the citizenry, but only certain sections of the citizenry, as it moved along, as it evolved further, it embraced more and more. And one of the telling things is, there was, although there have been, what do you call it when they make changes or
amendments.
Yeah. None of the amendments have been to against anyone. It's more for someone. So you can see this evolution, this slow, step-by-step understanding of the broadening of what true morality is, or what morality is among the citizens who have lived during these times and have laid their lives on the line to push this evolution through. And the study of it is a wonderful thing, because we're looking at it on just individual basis, which is a good place to look, but also on the basis of the societies themselves.
The contribution having to do with how where government has looked at its population, its people, and how is that has expanded to enfold or envelop more of the population than rather just the higher classes. And we think part of that also has to do with the education of the populace, whereas it used to only be the rich that got educated. Once, you know, the whole thing with the printing press, once books became more affordable and readily available and people got educated, that's when the aspect of who these laws were going to benefit became even broader. So we think that it's important to look at a consistent education system for the populations, because that's the only way that people are going to be able to really benefit themselves. But the education then has to be a universal aspect too, and not the whole thing with competition and, you know, I got a better mark than you. The focus of education has to change as well. It has to go along with the times. So we still have some time. Yes?
We were just going to say, we think the doctrine of reincarnation and karma would be the cure for our societies at this time, because irrespective of whether you are rich or poor, we learn that we were all born with a certain life pattern that we live out. So we then be so eager to look at other people's patterns, but pay more attention to our own, and how it would also help us to feel more a part of other people when we realize that each one has his own path.
Yes, the idea of even teaching karma and reincarnation, could you just see that in our public school systems? But that whole idea, it would, the idea of true morality and karma and reincarnation certainly do go together, because when we're looking at people being held responsible for their actions, then if somebody knows that if they do something wrong in this life, they're bound to pay for it at some other time, then they might be more apt to look at that, at the idea of universal brotherhood and doing good for all. Yes?
Well, psychologically, is that any different? Certainly in a practical way, getting people to behave in a way that's hurting one another. A belief, a conventional belief in an outer deity, if you're good, you go to heaven, you're dead, you go to hell, doesn't that have the same effect on people's behavior?
Well, doesn't the idea of an outside deity, a vengeful one that if you do bad, then you may be punished, as opposed to karma and reincarnation. Did you have a...
Well, maybe a metaphor for that is no one is allowed to know anything about arithmetic. No one. It's privileged. It belongs to the high-ups. It's a godlike thing. So you go to the grocery store, and they tally up your groceries, and you hand them some money, and they give you back some change. It's all completely faith, and you have no idea whether you've been fairly treated or cheated. And you may know that your neighbor bought the exact same things and didn't spend as much money. So you know there's something going on. Now, what if you turn it around to everybody knows and understands mathematics? If you want to learn it, if you want to take the responsibility, then you can stand there and figure out for yourself, am I being treated fairly? There is a huge difference between assuming someone's treating me fairly and knowing it for certain within yourself. If I am responsible, I have no one else to blame, no one else to turn to. But that's the negative side of karma. The positive side is, I don't need anybody else. I can do it. Just as I made the mess, I can make better.
And the idea, too, is, I mean, when we're looking at the idea of motive, the motive behind not doing it because I don't want God to get mad at me is certainly different than that it's wrong to hurt somebody. So, you know, it's an interesting conversation that could be continued for a whole other class. Yes, sir.
And as a bad vibration, just my treating somebody bad or having some kind of thought, it affects my whole health.
Mm-hmm.
It affects me, you know, it affects how I think, how I sleep, how I move around. It's just a bad vibration walking around with that kind of state of mind. You know, it just doesn't feel healthy. Doesn't feel peaceful. So.
No, and they say that, they talk about how emotions and your way of thinking affect your physical health. So if you're constantly, like we were talking about the money, you know, if you're afraid because you don't have it, and if you have it, then you're afraid of losing it, you're in a constant state of stress. And there's medical proof about what stress can do to your body. So if we're more accepting and loving, then your body's ills will follow suit, just like that. Did you have your hand up?
Oh, no.
No? Did it? Yes.
We were just thinking about the idea of the kind of world that we live in. We know that each one has his own delusions. And that's why it's so important that we study ourselves, because we don't think properly about everything. But the more we understand ourselves and who we really are, then we can understand better the world around us and all of the people that we have to deal with.
Yes, the idea of learning about yourself, and we know that the Gita, it's a wonderful study that we do every summer, or almost every summer, and it's learning how to learn about yourself, and the whole idea that the Gita talks about with the three qualities, you know, how that affects you, and the idea of not looking for an attachment or an expectation when you do your duty. And we know that that's you know, that's very important in today's age, because it seems like a lot of people are looking to get what they can out of life, and they're looking at the material aspect and not the spiritual one. Yes?
What hasn't come up, what was in the park, was that we are never left alone in this mm-hmm. world, that we are always protected and guided and made to reach up to those spiritual masters if we but put the work into motion. But we were fascinated by the line that said they hold back the awful karma so that it can be experienced slowly and gradually when we can deal with it. So we are never, the Asper says, we're never without a friend, we're never in this work alone, and that's a very hopeful statement.
Yeah, to read that part, it says, they try to direct the results in a better channel. They hold back the awful karma that would shake the world and let the effects come so gradually that we can stand and bear them. So they're not changing it. It's not like they're wiping out their karma. They're just kind of slowing it down, so to speak. And let the effects come so gradually that we can stand and bear them. That is part of the protective power of the spiritual nature, and it operates in every direction. Yes?
And one might observe, as much as yesterday was the 9th anniversary, a very terrible day, it would seem that occasionally they do let Lao loose some awful karma. And maybe they think that maybe humanity is ready to look at this.
Yeah, it's interesting when one has knowledge of karma and reincarnation and studying the Gita and all the other wonderful writings that we have, one gets a completely different take on what's going on in the world today. And it's just very interesting to see the part that Mr. Judge talks about the human as being a dynamo of energy, and how we can affect the natural world as well. So it's an interesting perspective shift. Yes?
Well, I don't know that we can say that they allow something to happen. I think what we can say is what we're given there, that they sometimes step in to prevent huge things, and the smaller things are set up and are going to come, whether they're floods or earthquakes or volcanoes or people acting against people. But the huge things that would overwhelm us all, obviously they do try to delay it some.
We have time for one or two more questions. One thing we did want to read was on page 122. Each one of us represents both the spirit, the highest divine nature, and also the very lowest, the infernal nature. Man is spiritual, in fact, but thinking himself material and separate and acting in accordance with his thinking, he brings about the battle between the two natures within him. So we can actually think that when he's talking about the battle between the two natures, that this is what we're trying to win, the higher nature, to win, to bring up the lower nature, to be more partners with the higher. And that is our reason for being here. So thank you very much, and have a wonderful day. Our meeting's over.